Hello, and welcome to Fidelity Connects, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Today, we speak to Fidelity's Vice President of ETFs, Andrew Klee, as well as Fidelity Boston's Lead Portfolio Strategist, Paul Ma, as they speak to the fundamentals of ETF portfolio construction in today's volatile market. Andrew and Paul speak to Gord Thompson, Regional Vice President of Western Canada, as they discuss growth versus value amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Andrew and Paul explain how these trends have progressed historically through past recessions. They both share points on how they would position portfolios during the recovery from the global pandemic. They also discuss how to diversify away from the U.S. election volatility and where to find opportunities across the globe. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets is frequently changing. Today's podcast was recorded on September 2nd, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Hello, everyone. Gord Thompson here, Regional VP for Western Canada for Fidelity Investments Canada, and welcome to today's Fidelity Connect. Today's a third part, I guess, in a series that we're running, and that is on portfolio construction. Today, we're going to provide you with actionable perspectives on the COVID-19 economic and market recovery by taking a look at three things. Number one, we're going to take a look at how this recovery may be similar to the one that we went through about 10 years ago through the financial crisis. Secondly, we'll take a look at the outlook for market leadership in terms of different investment styles. And then thirdly, we'll take a look at a bunch of different scenarios that could transpire in the different playbooks and ETFs that you may want to consider to implement in your practice. To help us with this conversation, we've got two frequent guests that are very well known, the Fidelity Connects audience, and that is Andrew Klee, our VP of ETFs in our Toronto office. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks, Gord. Happy to be here.
And from our Boston office, we have Paul Ma, who is a VP and portfolio strategist for U.S. business. Paul, welcome.
Great to be here.
Now, I'll just quickly, for the audience, give them a bit of an overview of the Fidelity ETF lineup. We started it about 2 years ago, and we're at about $1.75 billion in assets. So we'll bring that up right now and just quickly show you, because the key ones from the standpoint of what we'll be talking about today will be the ones along the top lines there, the dividend, low vol, high quality, value, and momentum series. So each one of these themes have three individual ETFs underneath them. We have one focused on Canadian stocks, and then U.S. stocks, and then international stocks. We also have a fixed income lineup for our ETFs. You can see that down below. We also have an ESG, Sustainable World ETF. And then what we've done is also brought in our asset allocation team to build portfolios similar to our actively managed portfolios under the Fidelity FMP umbrella. We also have a couple of Canadian and global monthly income ETF mandates you can take a look at. Okay, Paul, why don't we start with you? And there's been a lot of, you know, advisors wondering from the standpoint of where we are in the cycle. And, you know, what's one of the most commonly asked questions that you're fielding these days from advisors about that topic?
Yes, Gord. The top question, really, believe it or not, is value versus growth. In fact, let me ask you guys the question, advisors, well along the line. Think to yourself, raise your hand if you believe that value outperformed growth last year in 2019. You think about it for a second, all right? So I bet a lot of you thinking that value did not really outperform growth last year, right? Well, actually, if you look at S&P 500, the first bar there, S&P 500 value actually outperformed S&P 500 growth last year by a little bit, but definitely held its own and outperformed. It is the Russell 1000 value when you go slightly lower in market cap, that underperformed Russell 1000 growth. So there's a lot just trying to say here is that the value versus growth story is not as clear cut as a lot of people think. And so far this year, growth has certainly outperformed value, and especially large growth, because in a sort of a recessionary environment, we're stuck at home watching a little bit too many Netflix videos or ordering too many packages from Amazon, right? These large growth names actually do really well. I mean, that's sort of a growth, that's what they do well in recession, right? So the question really from our advisor clients right now is that, well, recessions where large growth, the growth names do well, shouldn't early cycle, the recovery, right, where business come back to functioning, when value names start to take over or smaller cap things like that start to take over. So that's a hot question that a lot of advisors are asking.
And that answer does surprise me because I wouldn't have guessed that the performance was so good on the value side. Andrew, any comments you'd like to share on that topic?
No, I think you nailed it. It is a surprise, but I also think it's region and benchmark specific. So I think what draws attention in my mind is the trends on how they play out throughout the world, because value internationally or Canadian, for example, had a very challenging year. So I think you need to consider A, what am I doing in a region? And B, what kind of style exposures am I looking at when I'm putting together my portfolio? Because contradictory or complementary factors can help reduce that style bias that some portfolios face.
Okay, so maybe I'll throw this back to Paul. What's driving the value or growth of performance historically?
So historically, value has outperformed growth. If you look at 30 years back, right, from 1970s all the way to 2008, then something happened and growth started to outperform value starting 2008 to today, all right? So let's think about what's the difference, right? What's value really? Value are driven mainly by banks, financial stocks. I know Canada has a lot of big banks in the composition, right? So think about value as banks and some energy companies also, and material companies also big in Canada. So these sort of value names outperform. So why did they outperform through 1970, 1982, 2008? Well, because I mean, a U.S. company like a Citibank, for example, they start to leverage up. So when they take in $1 million deposit, they start lending out $2 million, $5 million, $10 million to the point of $35 million, 35 times levered by the time financial crisis 2008 happened, right? So, I mean, that if that's a good business model, that's pretty good for making more money, right? If you keep levering up by taking in $1 million deposit and lending out $35 million. So, of course, as you lever up more, whether it be banks or individual investors who actually buy houses start to, 2008, famously flipping houses with no money down, and anybody living in Florida own five houses, right, flipping around these houses. So that sort of leverage, whether it be by banks or by individual households, from 1970 to 2008 is one reason why value really outperformed growth. However, Dodd-Frank stopped that. The legislation in the U.S. that sort of like, tell banks to be careful lending, do not lever up, right? Citibank now go from 35 levered to about 10 times levered, right? So that's sort of a way of making performance is sort of over right now, right? So now the question is growth, which is represented by technology, right? Names like that are innovative, right? They're trying to innovate, and that's a question. Are they here to stay? That's a question. So historically, that's just sort of the break in 2000, a really interesting historical chart.
Okay, thanks for that, Paul. Now, history can be a useful guide in navigating the markets. What did the recovery from the credit crisis about a decade ago and recession look like? And maybe we'll just check in with Andrew from the standpoint of things we learned from that time period.
Yeah, so that was what I would say is more traditional type recovery that Paul touched on earlier. So there was no concern about reopening the economy. The question was more so, what does future growth look like? What does the interest rate policy look like from the Federal Reserve and the Bank of Canada? And then how do we get back to a 3-5% GDP growth target, right? I think this time you have to have a view on what the reopening of the economy does, because let's not confuse what caused the recessions. There was exuberance in the market in 2008, lofty valuations, this time we were doing pretty well as an economy in the developed world, at least. And then a global pandemic hit and we had to shut everything down. So I think there's a lot of concern about what reopening the economy looks like. So I think you need to have a view. As a vaccine comes and we go into a full recovery mode like we saw in 2008, that's where I still think that you see value and small caps lead that recovery, because these are the stocks that got beat up the most year to date. And then if you look at 2009, for example, some of those U.S. value names or the U.S. dividend names outperformed the S&P 500 by about 30% in that calendar year of 2009. But if you're of the view that COVID's here to stay and we're never going back to the world the way it was, perhaps we need to consider that growth is very, very scarce, and that you could actually see a growth leadership on the downturn, but that continue through the other side, because when you have interest rates at zero, banks can't make much money. And we had the Fed coming out saying, hey, there's 5 years of this. And then also growth comes at a premium. So you could actually see that leadership continue into the recovery, depending on your view of what return to normal looks like.
Hey, thank you. Paul, any comments, Dad?
No, that's great. Great summary. The difference between last time, this time. All right. So what Andrew was talking about, this sort of recession and recovery, 2008, 2009, we put in these graphs, right? The recession, the last sort of part of that graph, right? To early cycle, that's 2008 to 2009. And then you have the mid cycle, like 2010 to about 2018, and the late cycle, like 2019, where, GDP is sort of, unemployment is full, everybody's working, and valuation gets really high. So any crisis tips it into recession. So that's what the business cycle we're looking at, right? So the typical early cycle that Andrew's talking about is where, you know, we go through recession and GDP recovers really fast. We're going back to work, right? And recovering. And that's where value and small cap that did not work so well during recession start recovering, right? But this cycle is where, I mean, we're still working from home. So this recovery is very different. We have, you know, coronavirus, we have election risk in the US as well, right? Not in Canada, but in the US. So there's a lot of uncertainty in the air that if this recovery the same as last one, we can just sort of go from the momentum or growth factors to go to value factor right now, right? Perhaps you want to be more balanced this time, right? The idea is that, if a vaccine comes around, maybe that's it's a good sign to be more tilted toward value. But then again, this all these risks, election risks, coronavirus might come back around again, that the certainty of earnings by Amazon and Netflix, right? Those are precious when there's no great recovery and growth back. We're still stuck at home working. They might want to sort of have a more balanced approach to growth versus value.
Okay, thank you. Now, in terms of just the playbook or the roadmap advisors should be using in this type of environment, what would you both recommend? We'll start with Andrew.
Yeah, I think Paul highlighted something that's incredibly near term and also unknown, is you're seeing a lot of flows right now head to international equity. And the reason we see that is on the ETF side is the institutions tend to use ETFs as a liquidity vehicle. So I do put some credibility into where that flows are going. But one of the big overhangs of the US market is the election. So if you're looking to diversify away from election risk, A, you get attractive valuations in international developed markets because they are trading at a cheaper price to earnings compared to the US market, but you also remove that election risk. And particularly if you're of the view that we are in this for longer and a vaccine won't send us back to it, I think you need to look at something like international high quality or international momentum. They tend to be heavier exposure to those growth sectors that Paul was talking about, like technology. And then if you're a believer that, hey, we're going to get back to normal quicker than we expect, I think you need to be looking at something like international value or international dividends, because those sectors that we have overweights there have really, really underperformed on a year-to-date basis. But if you're looking at something like 2009 on that recovery where it's sharper than expected, those types of sectors have a lot of torque to the upside if that recovery plays out in a more similar fashion that we saw historically.
Yeah, I like to follow up what you said about international, is that it's actually very attractive right now. Not only does it doesn't have the election risk, binary risk, there's something very unusual happened in Europe, actually. Which is that Germany finally signed up for a Eurobond. The reason why it's so important that people don't talk about it enough, but so important is that Germany resisted issuing Eurobonds for decades and decades, even during Greek crisis or financial crisis last time, right? They refused to issue Eurobond because what Eurobond really is German taxpayer paying into a bond that Greek Italian citizens can spend freely, right? That's not a great idea for German taxpayer, right? So they resisted that idea of Eurobond. But the question is, why did Angela Merkel finally capitulate and decide to issue Eurobonds about a couple weeks ago, really? And it's a game changer. I tell you, the reasons why is that, well, think about the world right now. You're going to have China and U.S. fighting each other, right? Their own ecosystem, hopefully. Where does Europe sit? Can they really count on the U.S. or not? Number one. Number two, you have Britain leading Europe pretty soon. And that imagine in the U.S., you have Florida leaving the U.S. or something like that. That's what it feels like, right? Well, California leaving the U.S., Britain leading U.S., leading Europe, maybe Italy or Greece will follow. So Europe is thinking that, my goodness, I might be disintegrating and I don't have a voice in the world, right? So what's one way to save that is to have German taxpayer go ahead and issue the Eurobond for Italians and the Greeks to spend the money freely, right? It's a very unappetizing thought for Angela Merkel, but for the sake of Europe, they will issue it. But have you noticed that once they march on that road to issue Eurobond, Euro has appreciated against dollar, right, very strongly the last couple of months and stuff. And that's the reason why, because people suddenly realize that this Europe experiment is for real, that the Euro, the currency associated with Europe, might be for real and here's to stay. So that's very important. That's why international investing becomes really interesting for us, not only because it's cheap, no election risk, but the fact that Europe existing as an entity is for real now.
Okay, thank you for that. So you both mentioned the U.S. presidential election, and it is heating up. We've gone through, obviously, both conventions. The Republican one was last week, a couple weeks ago, is the Democratic one. Is there anything we can learn from history in terms of different investment styles that, you know, work during, you know, up and down markets associated with the U.S. presidential election?
Well, I can start and then Andrew can follow. First thing we learned from last election is that don't trust the polls. Okay. We have no idea. So last time the consensus was that who's going to win? Hillary, right? And what if the consensus that if Trump won, what's going to happen to the stock market? Is it going to tank, right? Those consensus did not work out very well. So what the market learned from last time is that we have no idea about the election impact. So let's not, that's why the market has not moved with the election in mind, because market realized we have no idea. Okay, so let's get closer to the election. Let's see a debate or two before we make that assessment. So that's number one about that, right? Number two, though, however, is more serious, which is that if Biden during debate starts shifting really to the left, right, then I think the market will start thinking about, does communism, socialism really work? Well, I mean, as Venezuela has shown us, socialism is no bueno, all right? It's just not something that doesn't work, really. And maybe, so the question there is people have to assess going from capitalism to a semi-socialist state, right? Is that a path that's good for equity market for America and for North America? So that's something that people have to judge in October, November, that people think about that.
Andrew, any additional comments to share?
Yeah, I think Paul nailed it. As we don't know the outcome of the election, we also don't know how the market will react, because I recall sitting in my condo with some friends watching the election back in when Trump took office, and seeing the Dow futures limit down and crash, to come into work the next morning to find out that we were going to open much, much higher because the market caught on to the corporate tax reform. So I think with that background, I think it's important to look at what kind of the key tenets of the presidential platform is. And then you can start looking at investments that may benefit from that. So I think, take Joe Biden, for example, this green energy stuff that he's been looking at is a key tenet of his platform. So a possible way to hedge some of that risk is if he wins, take a look at something like our Sustainable World ETF. We're going to be incredibly underweight energy. We're going to have very low exposure to materials. We take a best-in-class approach. But if he comes in with a green bill and takes office, I think it's fair to say that we could probably see some pressure on those types of sectors. So take a look at what's actually each president is running on. The key is that once they're in office, they actually need to pass that through the House and Congress, right? But that's how you start looking at ways to play a presidential nominee win without having to take longs or shorts bets or taking concentrated risk. So I think that's another consideration.
Yeah, and it's not too late to wait until the election happens, right? Because imagine last time, if you actually wait until the day after the election to make your assessment, that's not too late, right? That's not too late. So getting ahead of the game, however, I thought a lot of people actually sold out of their stock portfolio before election, this and that. That'll be a foolish bet. So just wait.
Okay. In terms of big picture ETF industry question, we get asked a lot by advisors, you know, how's the industry going to grow, both in the U.S. and Canada. The U.S. is obviously a lot bigger, Paul, so maybe we'll check in with you first. And is there anything that's happening out there just from an industry perspective, there's trends and strategies that retail advisors should be thinking about today?
Yeah, the wonderful thing is that ETF is growing because the low fees on it, the tradability of it. U.S. is growing really fast, right? And the great thing is that there's a lot of these non-vanilla ETFs coming out. For example, quality ETF for investors who think, you know what, I like the market, but I only want to buy quality companies, right? Or ones that give me dividends, or ones that's sustainable, right? As Andrew said, maybe Joe Biden's policy is more green one, so I might want to buy a sustainable ETF. And that's so that's sort of a lot of these proliferation of different kinds of ETF give people option to really let events happen and play to what the winners and losers. There'll be a lot of winners and losers after this election.
Okay, what about in Canada, Andrew? What are you hearing and seeing?
Yeah, we're already at, if the year ended today, we would have had the highest flows on record in the history of Canada on a year-to-date basis. So I think pending that nothing terrible goes sideways for the rest of the year, we're looking at a blockbuster year in terms of flows. And then I also like to dig into the trends in the flows. I think this is particularly interesting for a Canadian advisor, is the trends between currency hedged and unhedged U.S. equity flows. So generally, a lot of people like to run unhedged U.S. dollar just because it's a safe haven currency and tends to get a nice bid when we're in recessions, which softens the downside for many Canadians. But we actually saw a dramatic shift in March and April, where the flows became heavily favored to currency neutral or CAD hedged ETFs, and significantly outflows from the unhedged versions. Because I think there was a lot of concern about the US dollar, because they had issues with the coronavirus itself. But I think you're also starting to see headlines about the question of the US dollar as the reserve currency around the world. But I would say at about mid-June, that actually flipped, where now we're starting to see tremendous flows go back into unhedged assets. And it's coming out of the expense of the CAD hedged assets, as people are realizing that the US is managing through this not too as bad as they thought. And also they're starting to realize that the Canadian economy is also starting to have its own troubles. And if you think about ourselves, we're an exporter, right? So a lot of the way that we can manage our export business is through currency management. And so I think the important thing to remember is that currency is always relative. Canada may be doing bad, but the US is also doing poorly. And it's who's doing worse that determines the view of that currency, right? And the response to that central bank. So I think we saw a big risk off from the US dollar at the early start of COVID. But one of the trends that we're noticing over the last couple months is renewed interest in those unhedged assets. So keep an eye out for that.
Okay, so just coming up to the end of this Fidelity Connects video, so thought I'd check in again, and maybe we could just, for the benefit of the audience, go over what a COVID-19 recovery portfolio of ETFs may look like.
Sure. So I'll take the view of vaccine comes and we actually recover quicker than expected, just because I think that allows Paul to take the other side of it. And by no means is that a view. I'm not a doctor. I don't know what the vaccine actually looks like. But what I would say is, if you're a view that this is going to be a sharper recovery than the market's currently pricing in, then I think you need to be looking at things like value and dividend. Consider a small cap manager like Steve McMillan in Fidelity America Small Cap. And the reason I say that is, if we're opening up faster, the cyclicals like the banks or the energy, and we get back onto driving our cars to work every single day, demand for oil goes up. And those sectors are the ones that have been beat up the most on a year-to-date basis. And we're starting to see some change in the leadership. So you'll notice for today, for example, the Dow Jones is your best performing index today. And I kind of use the Dow as a gauge towards value stocks because it is more heavily tilted towards there. And then we actually have NASDAQ as the worst performing index on the day, which is your benchmark for type growthier technology stocks. And we have S&P 500 kind of in the middle. So we're starting to see some interesting dynamics where value is starting to show some life. It hasn't on a year-to-date basis, but I think those are the camps that if you're pro-vaccine, we return to normal quicker than we expect.
Okay, Paul, so we'll check in with you on the other side of things.
Okay, let's bring up slide number three so we can talk about it because I agree with Andrew in the short term, but I disagree with him over the long term. So this is about time horizon, because I always say that people who are bearish or bullish, I always say that they're both right and both wrong, depending on their time horizon. Because even broken clock is right twice a day, right? So in the business cycle horizon, I actually agree with Andrew, because we're going through recession, recovery now. Every day we're closer to a vaccine. So people who have made a lot of money in growth will shift to value, the underperforming thing that, so if GDP growth start coming back, going back to office, right? Everything is growing, you might as well buy the cheapest one, right? So value will come back in a shorter term horizon. But I also want to focus people on the longer term horizon, the secular 10 to 30 year horizon. That to me is a very important horizon, right? So in the long term horizon, you ask yourself a question. In 10 years, do you believe technology, will technology be a bigger part of S&P 500? Or will bank be a bigger part of S&P 500? Right. And if you can answer that question to yourself, to me, I'm thinking technology probably the case, because then can lever up, but technology can innovate, right, to make a larger part of S&P 500. If that's the case, then, you know, you got to really keep that in mind, that long term investors are interested in growth names and momentum names. That's what the names, right? And that these short term value names, a rally, at a certain point will fade out as well. So just make sure that your portfolio is balanced. It's constructed carefully, maybe tilt a little bit of value, but don't give up on that growth momentum names, right? That's sort of we're looking at a longer horizon. So keep your time horizon in mind.
Okay, so maybe I'll conclude by saying I'll go right up the middle, and I'd recommend possibly if you don't know exactly what's going to happen, which a lot of us don't, certainly take a look at our Canadian monthly high income ETF, that's FCMI, and then our global monthly high income fund, FCGI, which essentially purchases all of our mutual funds and does it diversified way. And where required, we'll take a look at some third-party ETFs as well in those portfolios. So please consider those two mandates as well. So why don't we close off, Paul? Andrew, thanks very much. Appreciate you joining us today. And I know the viewers all appreciated hearing from you once again.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. Please visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.